Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on March 27, 2018. This Tuesday's class is the 10th week of our 2018 12-week Dhamma study based on my book, The Truth of Happiness. Our study this week is on karma. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So we're this week's talks classes are going to be on karma Thursday and Saturday too. The reason why I say that is I'm not going to keep trying this. The recording's not working, so we'll make another one Thursday. How is everybody with the course? I know, Lady, you haven't been with us. We're in the middle of that Truth of Happiness course again, and. The last 4 weeks we've been going over the not-self characteristic impermanence, how that misunderstanding of those two phenomena results in ongoing disappointing experiences, and dependent origination in five clinging aggregates, how dependent origination states from ignorance of Four Noble Truths through 12 observable causative links, all manner of suffering arises. And the five clinging aggregates describe that, or the five clinging aggregates are the personal ongoing experience of suffering. Does everybody have that? Do you have a general working knowledge of what that is? Okay. So karma is another one of those greatly misunderstood and misapplied words. Usually it's applied from the point of view of Vedic influence, which would be modern Hinduism. The Buddha studied that and rejected that during his time. But he used the term karma because it was a common term, but he used it, a common word, but he used it in a completely different way, even contradicting what the common use of the word was, and he did that for a purpose, to make the point that you're looking at the world in such a confused way, you're even making up words that strengthen the confusion, and insisting that karma is reward or punishment does just that. The idea that karma is retribution or reward for behavior is something deeply rooted in it's deeply rooted in the Vedas, but it's deeply rooted in eye making. I hope I can explain this. To think that there's a supreme creator being or a overarching spiritual discipline that's acting on us, that is using some grand universal behavior modification system. It's silly when you put it that way, or it sounds silly, but that's exactly how it's viewed. And of course, that can't be true. How could it be true? We would have, there'd be no possibility of awakening if outside forces could act on us in that way and keep us under their thumb. Of course, the Buddha looked into this deeply, and that's one of the things that he realized. It's one of his profound understandings, is that there is no overarching spiritual system acting on us. The results of our own behavior are experienced by us. Now, of course, there's consequences established in society for aberrant behavior, but we're not talking about that. You can cover that in the umbrella of karma. So karma, what is karma? Karma is the present moment unfolding of past intentional actions moderated by the present level of our mindfulness, which means what we're holding in mind. The present moment unfolding of past intentional actions. So what that means that most of the things that we do that we have no real intention behind, meaning, and the intention we're talking about is the intention towards craving and clinging. If there's no intention behind our behavior, there's no karma that's produced. But that's not much of our behavior. Most of our behavior produces karma in that way. It creates conditions in our mind that unfold in this present moment. Now, as those conditions, that's the wrong way to say it, as life was unfolding, because my mind is conditioned from past behavior, I react to things. It's that reaction in the moment that's creating the karma of that moment. It's creating the experience of that moment. Is that clear? Mm-hmm. So if my mind is conditioned from past behavior and the same general thing occurs and I react in the same general way, oh, that's my karma making these experiences similar. It's not karma making these similar. It's not karma driving you into situations to prove something to you or to show you the results of your behavior. It's simply what's occurring in your mind. So if you want to know what your karma is, take a few minutes to meditate, concentrate your mind, develop the framework of the Eightfold Path so you can see it clearly, and then look at it. Look at the contents of what's occurring in your mind and what's occurring in your life. And how are you reacting or responding to that? That's your karma. And karma shows you, in maybe a too much of a moment-by-moment way, the state of our mindfulness, what we're holding in mind. That's karma. It's not the objects of the events that are unfolding in our life that produces karma and experiences karma. It's our own minds and what we're holding in mind. So the external events as our life unfolds is a completely impersonal and karma-free experience. Is that clear? It's when we engage in the world in such a way that we create the experience that our past intentional actions are driving in that moment based on what's unfolding. Again, it's simply the way that we're coming in contact with the world and reacting or responding. And if the present level of our mindfulness is framed well by the Eightfold Path and our minds are well concentrated, it will be a peaceful moment and will no longer contribute to any disturbing or agitating karma. Our life will continue to unfold. Let me read. Is that clear where I'm going? Oh, yeah, you had a question. I'm sorry.
Could you say you're actually choosing to have the next moment the karma of the next?
Yes. You're not choosing the event.
Very, very deep, and it takes a lot of concentration to see that. But yes, you're actually choosing that you're going into the next moment with karma or without karma.
Yes. And so another way of saying that is you're choosing to go into the next moment ignorant and continue your karma or not. I know that's a hard word, but remember, we're talking about ignorance of Four Noble Truths, not a general ignorant human being. So in that way, that points to directly to what do? We have to find a way to cease creating, to cease having our intentions driving or providing momentum for future unsatisfactory experiences. Again, that's another way of just saying what the Buddha taught, is how to do that, how to bring karma to cessation, bring the agitating results of past intentional actions to cessation. The momentum of our life continues. But because we are now well concentrated with a calm and peaceful mind that cannot be touched in any way, we remain calm and at peace. But that's still karma, isn't it? It's still the present moment unfolding of past intentional actions, but now moderated by an awakened mind. Yeah. And like we talked about on Saturday, was it Saturday? I can't remember. Last week, we were talking about if there's no feeling arising. I can't remember exactly as the Buddha said it. If there's no feeling arising in the form property, meaning in the present moment, is there any karma unfolding in that moment? I'm paraphrasing that. And there's no compensatory karma. How's that for a phrase? Meaning there's no karma unfolding in the moment to compensate or to enlighten past behavior, shine a light on it. It's simply now our life unfolding as an awakened human being. And when you look at it that way, as an awakened human being, I can continue to move my mind or continue my mind resting in the framework of the Eightfold Path, and so no longer create any more, to use the word, negative karma, or karma that will be noticeable to me. My life now just unfolds. Let me get to a little bit of the quote from...
karma that would agitate you.
Yes. And in that way, then karma as a concept is useless. We don't have to consider it anymore. We're past it. But until that point, we better pay attention to it. The Buddha's words, I am the owner of my actions, heir to my actions. I am born of my actions. That one line, I am born of my actions. People don't understand what the Buddha is saying. It will take that as that somehow karma can give birth to human beings. What the Buddha is saying is that I am, this thing that is prone to suffering is born of karma. Not that human birth is driven by karma. But again, you would completely misunderstand that if you didn't understand the context of what the Buddha's teaching, right? It sounds like the Buddha's declaring that karma gives... Don't tell my mom and dad that. I am born of my actions and related through my actions. My actions will determine the fortune or misfortune in my life. And of course, the Buddha's not talking about gaining a big pot of gold, but the actual experience, the fortune or misfortune of each and every moment. And each and every moment is fortunate or unfortunate depending on the level of my mindfulness. Not what's occurring, not whether I happen to buy the lottery ticket, the right lottery ticket. Because even if I bought the right lottery ticket and won and my mind is confused, I'm probably going to be in trouble. How many times do we hear of lottery winners, ending up having pretty horrible, the next couple of years are pretty horrible for them, even though they have all that money. Because they're still acting from that, from a self-referential ego self. I'm going to flip around a little bit to what you read last week. Again, these are just some of the Buddhist quotes from last week's article. Whatever one continues to pursue with their thinking becomes the inclination of their awareness. In this sense, awareness is another, we could substitute mindfulness. Whatever one continues to pursue with their thinking becomes the inclination of their mindfulness. Whatever we pursue with our thinking is what we're going to hold in mind. Another way of saying is what we put our focus on is what we're going to manifest in our lives. In one way or another. Now again, I'm not talking about creative visualization and I focus on a pot of gold and a week later there it is. That's simply more eye-making, simply more deluded thinking. And that whole idea of using creative visualization to improve myself financially or in some other way, I'm going to grow tall or whatever it might be, or attract a million friends. It's simply more eye-making. It simply contributes to disappointing experiences. And I'm not going to get into that whole movement that we all grew up with. But that's the result of it. Every time I got into that behavior, I never tried to... Well, maybe I did. I never tried to visualize a calm and peaceful mind. It was always next month's rent. I'd rather have a calm and peaceful mind, and then I can deal with next month's rent. Do you understand what I'm saying? So that is one of the big differences. With the Buddha, the common teaching during the Buddhist time and today treats karma that way, which in a very subtle way teaches competition and acquisition, doesn't it?
Well, it's really a bigger form of society's way of keeping you in check.
Yes, and isn't it interesting how... The Buddha's teaching... excuse me. I got so excited about what you were saying, I didn't swallow. The entire Buddha's teaching is to recognize conditioned mind and where it comes from. The modern, and even during the Buddhist time, the common interpretation of karma leads to more acquisition and competition. It encourages eye-making at that level, at a very profound level. It encourages conditioned thinking. If I just act, if I act in a certain way, even Buddhism is taught, if you do enough prostrations in a certain number of rituals, the end result of your karma will be awakening. You're manipulating the situation rather than developing an understanding of your own mind and what's occurring. Rather than uniting your mind and your body, you're encouraging your mind to leave your body and go into the future when you're going to get the reward for all your wonderful behavior now. Rather than develop a well-concentrated mind, purify your mind. And this present moment is what we're all looking for, a heaven on earth, a calm and peaceful mind.
Even all the questions that were asked of the Buddha when somebody would die, the first question that would come up in people's mind and ask him was, is he going to, this higher realm, or is he... And it was like constant,
yep.
To the point where I think at one point he says, well, listen, here are the rules.
Yeah.
This is what happened, okay? If he does this, he does that.
Yeah. Even the Buddha used frustration to make a point. But it's very true. That question, even people that heard the Buddha over and over again would ask that question. Where do you go now? They knew that they weren't going to get a satisfying answer from the Buddha, but they kept asking, where does so-and-so go? What happened to Bahia now? The reason why the Buddha didn't get into long explanations of what happened, now we're going to get, it's interesting to bring this up, because we're going to get into next week the true meaning of rebirth, and I think we're going to spend a couple of weeks on it, because I've got some really interesting suttas that I haven't talked about in that way. The Buddha's teaching and the Buddha's point was to stop creating the conditions that would create any type of future birth. End it now. Karma is to be dealt with and brought to cessation as part of the Dhamma practice. Not that it's something evil or bad. The whole point of the Dhamma is to gain control of our intention so that wrong intention no longer fuels our experience.
So isn't it just a failure of the core teachings of three marks and the first noble truth? I mean, you have these...
If you don't get it, yes.
But you have this religion.
Yep.
And mm-hmm. hundreds of millions of people, and they want to know where they're going.
And yep. And it provides... It provides the answers to... I'm sorry to interrupt you. Religion provides those answers.
And that's the hook.
Where you're going, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And that's why they don't teach it. They don't teach the Buddha's teachings.
Well, it's just they can't be reconciled. You cannot reconcile what the Buddha taught, at least as far as I know. I shouldn't make absolute statements because I'll be proven wrong at some point. But you cannot reconcile the Buddha's teachings with most religions. How's that for qualifying that answer? Because it's not religious in any way. It's not trying to answer the grand questions. It's saying that those questions aren't important to the Buddha. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that they're not important to other people. They seem to be. The Buddha's saying, don't be concerned about where you're going and don't be concerned about where you came from. Be concerned about where you are. Put yourself in your place. But the only way to do that is from a well-concentrated mind framed by what we call the Eightfold Path so that we can have useful and skillful mindfulness in this moment as life unfolds. Is that getting to what your point is, David?
Yeah. It's almost easier for someone to think about what's next versus what's right
yeah.
now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, boy. The next moment is the big distraction in life, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Where am I going next? What's next for me? We're consumed by that. And we fail to live our life as our life unfolds because we're always in the future. Or we're conditioned by what happened in the past. It happens to everyone. Maura and I used to go to this restaurant in Lambertville, a Thai restaurant on the north end of town. I can't think of the name of it. Mm-hmm. No. All the way up by the health food store.
Yeah.
Is that Siam?
Thai Tita.
And we'd always get a laugh at this because this would happen. We went there often, usually once a week for a couple of years. So we got this treatment often. We'd walk in. The owner would make us feel like, we're the most wonderful people in the world. He'd seat us, and by his behavior, you could see that he's trying to talk us out the door as quick as possible because he realized that he's not going to make his fortune off of us. He's going to make his fortune off the next people that walk in the door. And this was literally what his thing was, his conditioned thing. He did it with everyone, not just us. It wasn't that we wore smelly clothes or anything. It was always the future was going to bring his pile of gold. And so he was never able to be present. I mean, he was a real nice guy. He served good restaurant, et cetera, et cetera. Those of you that have been there, you probably would notice that yourself. No? Well, he always seemed to want to get us out the door. And it was always the next thing that was going to be the most important. And that's how we live our lives. It's always, no matter what we have, a car full of brand new cars, it's the next car that we can't get our mind off of, isn't it? And that's a form of karma. It's because of my acquisitory nature, because of my greed, that I'm not happy with what I have right now. And my karma drives me to want more, because it's the way that my mind has developed, conditioned. And so karma is driving me to not be happy with the 40 cars I have. I need one more to be happy. That's karma. And imagine I'm trying to describe an agitated mind state. Am I doing it?
Yeah, you're doing just fine.
That agitated mind state is karma. Do you want it? Time to get rid of it. And how do we do it? How do we get rid of karma? How do we end karma? Through the Eightfold Path. We develop a calm and peaceful mind. I'm going to read that what I just read again. I'll read the whole thing through so I can continue it. So I finish it. Whatever one continues to pursue with their thinking becomes the inclination of their awareness. Being mindful of right intention and abandoning thinking imbued with craving, clinging, and sensuality inclines the mind towards awakening, towards release. Again, it's the Buddha's describing the entire Dhamma. Being mindful of right intention and abandoning thinking imbued with craving, clinging, and sensuality inclines the mind towards release. That's exactly what the Buddha's teaching. That's what the Dhamma is for. The Buddha says that karma should be understood correctly, which would imply that many people were understanding it incorrectly. The cause of karma should, these are the Buddha's words, karma should be understood correctly. The cause of karma should be understood, meaning craving and clinging. It should be understood. The diversity of the results of karma should be understood. Diversity means the unfolding of our karma happens in an endless amount of ways. And that in itself can be a distraction. Cessation of karma should be understood, and the path developing the cessation of karma should be developed, meaning the Eightfold Path. The Buddha's instructions on what to do with karma. The Buddha says, intention is karma. So remember when we learned about right intention is the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging? To continue with that theme, develop an understanding of craving and clinging. Craving initiates this whole process of conditioned thinking by leading to wrong views, and then once those views are established, clinging and identity to those views. And so right intention is the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging, recognize that process. And we've all described that here in class. It's at the point of restraint, at the point of contact, that we can practice restraint and begin to diminish the results of past karma, past intentional actions. And what is the cessation of karma? From the cessation of contact comes the cessation of karma. So, of course, the Buddha is not saying that to end karma we have to literally kill ourselves, stop contact with the outside world. But what last week we were talking about eye consciousness, ear consciousness, etc. That's the contact that the Buddha's talking about. Contact at the point of senses that's backed up or interpreted by consciousness rooted in ignorance. That's what the Buddha's talking about there. It's at that point that we engage in the Dhamma, at the point of restraint, at the point of understanding. And as we develop this deeper, and I think we all would say this, we develop an ongoing deeper understanding of dukkha, don't we? Isn't that true? Would you all say that you're developing a deeper understanding of dukkha, of suffering?
Yeah.
Lady, would you say, I don't mean to put you on a spot, you could just wave me away if you don't want to answer, but would you say yes to that too?
Maybe not right now, but I was at one point.
Okay, good. We'll get you back there. Lady distracted me that time. Let me get back to this. Read that last line. From the cessation of contact comes the cessation of karma. And how does one experience the cessation of contact? That's a question for all of you.
Through
before I give you the Buddha's answer. And how does one experience a cessation of contact? The Buddha says through the Eightfold Path. I'm just using that to emphasize that point that I hardly ever bring up the importance of the Eightfold Path. Yeah, I think it is. A fool and a wise person are both characterized by, these are, again, the Buddha's words, a fool and a wise person are both characterized by their actions. So it's not just you have that picture of the modern interpretation of karma and you, somebody with a black cloud over them, you know, as they're walking around in their karma. That's not it. A fool and a wise person are both characterized by their actions. So that person that's walking around with the dark cloud over their head but is smiling and is light and carefree, he's brought his karma to cessation, hasn't he? It is through the actions of one's life that reveals the fool or the sage. Sage. Through the actions, we reveal ourselves as fools or sages. And those of us in this room, including you, lady, you now know better. You have the framework for not being foolish ever again. Well, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know about that, but we have the opportunity here. 2,600 years ago, after this was presented, to develop a simple and direct eightfold path and gain full human maturity, and end the results of unskillful past intentional actions forever, and live the rest of our life in peace and happiness, no matter what occurs, no matter what unfolds. Pretty good deal, isn't it? Okay. It is through the actions of one's life that reveals the fool or the sage. The fool engages in three things: bodily misconduct, verbal misconduct, and mental misconduct. The sage engages in three things: good bodily conduct, good verbal conduct, and good mental conduct. Again, it's a simple key to the Dhamma, framed by right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Again, the brilliance of the Buddha. He teaches us something, but he doesn't leave us in the dark. He teaches us that our behavior is important if we're to end karma. But then he teaches us a simple and direct way to recognize and abandon poor behavior. It's almost too mundane to be important, except it's the most important thing. Again, karma is pointing us back to look at our behavior, be mindful of our behavior. And the Buddha supplied the antidote once we recognize poor behavior, the Eightfold Path. Now, hopefully I can describe how this brings it all together. From a well-concentrated mind now, we're able to develop the refined mindfulness that holds the principles of the Eightfold Path in mind, so that eventually, automatically, we respond in that mindful and skillful way and cease creating any future troublesome karma. Thus, friends, train yourselves as a sage in thought, word, and deed. And isn't that exactly what we're doing with the Eightfold Path? We're training ourselves in thoughts, in our words, and in our actions. It's usually in the reverse of that list that we start recognizing and becoming more skillful. It's usually through our deeds, through our actions, that we first recognize our unskillful behavior. And that's fine. You know, that's why the Buddha gave us the framework, so that we can use the skillful and unskillful aspects of it to recognize where we're out of agreement with the Eightfold Path. And that's all. And again, you could say that there's the great value in karma is showing us our conditioned thinking, our thinking rooted in ignorance. So we shouldn't be upset at karma, and we shouldn't particularly praise it. We should recognize it for what it is. It's simply an explanation for recognizing when we are stuck in wrong views or not. Because if our life is unfolding continually pleasantly, then we're seeing things clearly. And that doesn't mean, you know, just give it like 5 minutes, I'm good. But as a developed level of mindfulness, that's how we bring the unfolding of agitating karma to cessation, and awaken and develop lives of lasting peace and happiness. It's tonight's talk. this is leading to next week and probably 2 weeks and next week on rebirth. But keep that in mind, how bringing to karma to cessation brings future birth to cessation. And I think you understand that now. It has nothing to do with physical birth. It has a little bit to do with physical birth. But the important part isn't about a future physical birth. It's what I'm giving birth to in this moment. That's karma. So karma really doesn't have anything to do with physical birth. It has to do with what we're giving birth to in this moment. So I'd just like to hear what you think about that and what your understanding of karma as we go around the room. Ram, good to see you tonight.
I'm struggling with refining my view on karma here. Every time I think I've got to figure it out, out comes another sutta, and then it's. I don't have anything to say at the moment. I'm working on it.
I'm glad you're here. I look forward to it. David, good to see you.
It's almost as if the Buddha had a bit of a sense of humor in how he used the momentum of some of these words.
I agree.
The fire discourse and emptiness and karma and rebirth. It's almost like he used that momentum of that current cultural, hold on those words.
Oh, yeah.
And he would just turn it around and take the momentum. I think he was a bit of a wise guy sometimes.
Yep.
Because he must have been poking the establishment in the eye a little bit.
Yep. It's great that you see that. There's a give and take between the Buddha and one of the leaders of the Jain movement. I can't think of his name. I'll teach it here. I'll bring it in a month or so. But you really see that in the Buddha needling. I'm almost thinking of the guy's name, needling this Jain. But in a compassionate way, to make the point, to show everyone who's there, the monks that are there with the Buddha and the Jain followers, to show the foolishness of those types of beliefs.
It's that moment.
Keep
looking at that moment. Don't worry about the past. Don't worry about the next life.
Yeah. The whole Dhamma is to simply be present with our life as our life unfolds. And in order to do that, in order to develop the kind of life that we want, we have to be present for it, don't we? And again, that's what the Buddha's teachings brings us into our life in the present moment as our life unfolds. And that's where all freedom is in that moment. It's not in the past or in the future either. And that's a pretty good insight to tie it into the fire discourse, too. So thank you. Mary, good to see you.
Good to be here. Good to see everyone. Good to think that we're getting on a regular schedule again. Sort of easier said than done when it comes to karma. Unlike the part that was in the writings about we are heir. You're heir to our actions, or whatever that phrase was, that kind of stayed with me, that showed the future component in karma related to your action right here and now.
Mm-hmm.
But that was good to read, that one section that was in the newsletter. And then living it is, something entirely else. So, there are sometimes in the practice where you maybe not feel like you're starting over, but you're learning something like karma. It's not so undifferent than many other things that you've learned, but for me, I can see that there are things that still trigger me and my reaction to them comes out before I even had a chance to stop that, you know. So, you know, just an opportunity to continue becoming more aware of that, in order to, you know, is it renunciate karma or in order to slow it down?
Yeah.
I don't know if there's something before renunciation. Well, in order to stop this cycle.
Yeah. Well, recognizing it first. But that's,
So, you know, there's still opportunity there off the cushion. Because it makes sense to me. I understand it. You know, and then, as always, it's the living it, which is a little bit harder. But certainly recognizing it, even if it's post reaction,
oh, yeah,
is something.
Yeah.
So just continuing to hold the April path in mind as the solution.
Thank you. Yeah, it's so important to recognize it, and for probably all of us, it's in the beginning, it is post reaction, but at least at that point we have the understanding that in the Dhamma to do something at that point rather than just move on with our life and have that be a less than auspicious moment in understanding. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's such an important part of it. We tend to judge ourselves harshly at that point instead of realize how fortunate we are to recognize that there's behavior that I can change and should change.
Yeah, there's another way to look
yeah.
at it.
Yeah, and there is. I mean, we're fortunate right. to have this realistic framework to develop awakening.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lorna, good to see you tonight.
Good to be here and good to be back in the old familiar routine.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that you look at when you look at karma is that it reminds you that you make your own suffering. Or not, of course. but that's the in a sense the joyful side of the Buddha's teachings, that in a way we are in control of all this if we can just wrap our heads around it. It just reminds you that you are in control of your own suffering. Really, even though you don't appreciate it in some ways, but you know, we bring it all on ourselves. Really. And then I also think the Buddha is so meticulous in talking about karma, because it's actually your life unfolding at the very moment.
Yeah.
To hone your mind into what's happening right at this very moment, going into the next moment, which is of course where we live our lives, and it is a very important time. Although it's continuous and it's going on all the time, it's a very important time for us to observe that unfolding. We should be very mindful of it.
Yeah.
And I think that's all I have to say.
Wow. Thank you. One of the useful reasons the Buddha taught the Dhamma, there was one of the common philosophical groups during the Buddha's time and today is materialists that believe that we have one life and we're supposed to take everything we can out of that life. And some people see that differently. I mean, you know, whatever our pleasures are, we should take as much of them as we can because this is all we get. And that's the only meaning there is in life. And of course, teaching karma shows that that's not what's most important in life. What's most important in life is developing a well-concentrated mind framed by the Eightfold Path so that I don't give in to that type of greed that justifies a materialistic view of the world. And again, so karma is helpful in that way. But it's just a teaching to keep our minds inclined towards awakening. You know, that's all it is. So, thank you. Bonnie, good to see you tonight.
So I'm glad we're here again.
So am I.
I just keep thinking, like one of the ideas about, you know, if you follow this teaching to become fully awake and a fully mature human being, and I keep thinking that it drives you to be responsible.
Yeah.
It's about, you know, responsibility for your actions. action. I always thought of karma as sort of like, not that I'm a science buff or scientist, but it's like in physics, or for every action there's an opposite and equal reaction. And I would think of karma as being, you know, it's sort of whatever I put out, I get back. And that's, so I'm trying to wrap my head around, how does that notion...
Oh, it isn't.
Follow.
It isn't. Karma isn't. Karma isn't an equal sum game. It's not a. It's not a way of to somehow bring.
But if my actions from the past condition my behavior now to crave or to cling to something, and it condition, you know, so I have this conditioned response. Essentially, it's sort of, I bring this stuff on myself.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so what I'm saying is it's not a one-to-one, though. You can't, the point is that if I do something that's hurtful, at some point in the future, that exact same thing has to happen to me. That's how most people view karma, that it's some kind of universal balancing act. And that's simply not, has nothing to do with karma. It doesn't create a future for me that is bound by my past actions.
No, but
my response,
I'm just trying to figure it out, so to speak. So if my conditioned behavior gets me to respond in a way that keeps me, let's say, you know, nobody listens to me. Maybe. Or there's some things that I know nobody listens to me, but it's like what I do because of my conditioned behavior and my response keeps me in that. I'm just trying to see how that other framework that I had sort of helps me, or to not help me, but to think of the karma that, because essentially it's my responsibility to address, to witness, to be able to see how I respond, that creates, anybody just jump in.
I think you said something interesting, Bonnie, that you're,
I
the way you're looking at it, you're trying to reconcile an already established belief in what karma is with what you're hearing now, and the two can't necessarily be reconciled.
But I also think, and this is my sticking point too, is that we get to a point where we believe that we're responsible people. So when you have a whatever you might think a karmic reaction to something is, I might say to myself, oh, you know, I deserve that because I did that, and I have to take responsibility for that happened in the past. And now I have to be gentle with myself and kind of move on from there. So I think it's, you know, I don't know if it's exactly what Bonnie's saying, but I cling to this idea of being a responsible person, and I'm going to take responsibility for my actions. And I think that feeds into this whole karmic thing because it's I making.
It is. Yeah, that's where that's where the subtle aspect of this is important to understand. And that's why when you look at it as punishment and reward, as a one-to-one relationship, it doesn't work.
I'm not looking at it as punishment and reward necessarily. I'm looking at it that because if I it's so elusive. It's right there. No, wait, it was right there. It's that in order for me to be able to see that this reaction wasn't skillful, say, I can either say, well, I don't care, I'm going to keep doing that. If I want to be responsible to right action or right intention or right speech, I have to be able to... I think, essentially, for me, if it's what I've always taught. If you want to feel something different, you have to behave differently. If you want to behave differently, you have to see what it is that you're doing that brings the thing that causes discomfort or the stress.
Mm-hmm.
So in order for me to witness that, to see the thing that we talked about like how, oh boy, okay. I think for me it happens a lot less since I've been really practicing the Eightfold Path as a framework, but it's for me it feels like I can, because it's an adult thing to do, to say, oh, you don't want to feel that way, then you have to be mindful about how you speak to something. And if I keep doing it, I keep creating that thing in me to feel the stress in the way that's because of unskillful stuff. No?
Yeah, I get you.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, but
it's hard to get out of that merry-go-round.
But well, the witnessing for me helps me, you know, using the Eightfold Path to stand outside of that.
Isn't right view the thing that's missing in that merry-go-round?
She's only using part of the Eightfold Path.
Well, but that's the first thing. Without that, it's hard to recognize.
Well, without the framework of the Eightfold Path, you can't recognize it. I mean, that's why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path, to see that process unfolding.
So if you process in the present moment, if you focus on the tip of the arrow that Myrna talks about, that changes everything.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, because you could say that karma is the second, remember the Salatha Sutta, karma is the second arrow.
It's the second arrow?
Yes, mm-hmm. Karma is, I mean, again, we're using a word that has a lot of conditioning behind it, because we grew up with it. And we grew up with the conditioning that says that karma is a system of universal, I'm generalizing a little bit to make a point. Karma is a system of universal reward and punishment. Mm-hmm. And so we can't help but bring that in to what karma really is, you know, and it's that underlying conditioning that confuses. If you all heard about karma for the first time today, mm-hmm. I would bet that every one of you would understand it and you wouldn't be confused about it.
Right.
It's because of all that, of a lifetime of listening to what karma isn't, but thinking that that's what it is, mm-hmm. that now you hear the words of an awakened human being on exactly the same subject that contradicts almost entirely what we thought karma was. And that's where the difficulty is in applying it. So then our minds want to make it much more complicated than understanding karma really is. Karma is a present moment unfolding of past intentional actions moderated by the present level of our mindfulness.
But so when you say the second arrow,
which is
makes it really clear.
Yes, and the second arrow is the same thing. The second arrow is affected by the present level of our mindfulness or not. So if we want to awaken and we want to get out of the, this is a really great discussion, if we want to get out of the weeds of what it is and get to the heart of what it is, we stay focused on the Eightfold Path, because that's the only way to do it.
In the presence of the arrows?
In the present moment.
In the presence of. But you
said. I didn't hear what Liz said. In the presence of the arrows? Yes. Yes.
In the present moment. It's the idea, I loved this description, you know, when I first started, the idea of right speech. So if you make the conscious choice to live in right speech, then you never have to sit and think, oh, did I say something wrong? And then have that come back to you or whatever. It's very clear how you can eliminate suffering. If you follow right speech.
Yeah.
Because it's not only what you do to beat yourself up with, but it might be somebody else's reaction to what you said, you know, causing additional pain.
Yeah, yeah. That's why it's there. My mother could have awakened me when I was 5 years old because she told me all about right speech, but she did it with a bar of soap, and I didn't take it. But, I mean, it's true. I mean, I could have gotten it back then. You know, I could have understood it. And I guess this is where this is going. Thank you, Bonnie. The path to awakening is simple and direct. Anybody can develop it. But we have such deeply conditioned minds, conditioned towards continuing ignorance, that it's so hard to see these. And these really are simple. It's like dependent origination. The first 7,000 times I read it. But finally, it was like, this is the most simple and direct teaching. How come everybody doesn't get it? But a lot of people still don't understand dependent origination. It's a simple thing. Karma is a simple thing. It's just what's going on. If you want to know what your karma is, look in the mirror. Think about your day, your life right now. That's your karma. Do you want to alter it in a meaningful way? Sit down and meditate for a few minutes and learn about the Dhamma. Do what we're doing here. And it will completely transform your life from something that is going in karmically driven. Maybe that's the important thing about karma. Karma itself has no power. It's as insubstantial as anything else. It's part of the three marks of existence. But because of our own conditioned mind, it has tremendous power to continue to move our lives towards ignorance. That's what karma's job is to keep us distracted and keep us focused on, from this point of view of a self-referential ego self. But karma itself is completely impersonal like everything else. It's just what's unfolding. And if we want to take control of karma, develop the Eightfold Path. But Liz, before I get to you, had a comment, Lorna?
No.
A while ago? What Bonnie was saying? No? Okay. Liz?
I think I've said all I need to say. It's simple, but it's not easy.
Yeah, it's not easy. Thank you. Lady, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good.
How was your meditation tonight?
Well, I was good at focusing on my breath.
Huh?
And then towards the end, not so good.
Yeah, it got a little bit too long.
I haven't done any of it.
Yeah, so 20 minutes is a long time to meditate when you haven't been. If you're going to start again, I hope you do. Just 2 or 3 or 4 minutes, and if you can remember to do that twice a day, that'd be great. There's this new instruction, I don't know if you noticed that, is on the website, on the guided meditations, if you want to download and you can listen to it. But that relates to something called the Anapanasati Sutta, the Satipatthana Sutta, which are both on the website if you want to look it up, so you can understand. But I'm so glad you joined us again. I hope you do it again soon. Good. Thank you. Good to see you, lady. Keila, how are you? Thanks for bringing lady.
I get so jealous when you say that. Good thing I don't have an ego. No, I think tonight's teaching is really pretty profound. Mm. Although I struggle with the duality of those extreme terms of the sage and the fool. Mm. And I know that the Buddha was a great teacher and he was using those extremes to get the point across. But I think in our day-to-day existence, we're both. And those kinds of extreme terms kind of lend themselves to, feeling wonderful when you're the sage and feeling terrible when you're the fool. And I guess that's where the exercise is not getting too high from the highs, too low from the lows, and just being loving and humble.
That's it. Yeah.
But the words, I don't know.
Well, remember the Buddha gave this talk to a group of monks and nuns, and within the context of the Dhamma. So he's referring those words, a sage in reference to the Dhamma and a fool in reference to the Dhamma. And if you don't know the Dhamma, you're a fool. And again, he's not characterizing the person as a whole. They're foolish in relation to the Dhamma, or they're a sage in relation to the Dhamma.
The terms just seem harsh to me. But I understand the meaning underneath them.
Yeah, and the directness of the Buddha is so important, too, to make the point. You know, and if think about even the subject that he's talking about, the differences between someone who follows the Dhamma and who doesn't. You know, it needs to make a point. There needs to be an important point about that. And also the translation is from, well, this is probably Tanisaro's translation. So it's from the Pali into the English word. And so the English words that are used are fool and sage. Mm-hmm. But that's not necessarily the exact words that the Buddha used.
It's the same, initially it's the same feeling that you get when you use the word ignorance.
But
when you put it in reference to, it's not that you're an ignorant fool, or it's just that you're ignorant of the structure and format of the Dhamma and the skillful use of the information that's presented there.
Yeah. I guess it's the context.
But it's always the context.
I can understand, but these other two words, just I think in our day-to-day lives, if we absorb them too much, we can end up being very unkind to ourselves, or
mm-hmm. Oh yeah,
unkind to others.
Yeah,
we would put in that whole category. Mm.
All the more reason to keep it in context.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You said, but when you talked about the fool and the sage in relationship to karma, it was the fool and the sage are both seen, what did you say? Do you remember? And you said the fool and the sage were, they're both seen in the karmic life. No, that wasn't it. It was,
well, they appear the same. You can't tell the difference between a fool and a sage.
Because of,
well,
it was in relationship to how you applied the idea of understanding karma, and
I'm
comprehend something, because that was a little bit mind blowing in a way about the, because you're talking about
a fool and a wise person are both characterized by their actions. Is that what you're referring
yes,
to?
Yes, that's pretty just simple.
Is,
they're both characterized by their actions. So
yes,
whether it's wisdom or it's being foolish, we're judged no matter. You know,
not judge.
No,
when
you say characterize.
But it's saying they're two different people, and I think what I'm missing is that we're all those two different people inside
at some time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, but
yes,
and in relation to the Dhamma, you either develop the Dhamma wisely as a sage, or you don't. You disregard it, and that's again the Buddha. The translator needed to use the words that the Buddha used to distinguish between a person who is practicing the Dhamma and achieving success and someone who is ignoring the Dhamma. And so they're just words. They're not, he's not, yes, but as we're developing the Dhamma, we all are at times a fool and a sage. But the Buddha's talking about and using an example of someone who is completely devoted to the Dhamma.
Which is what
it takes to develop an Eightfold Path. It can be. Developing the or engaging in the Buddha's Dhamma could be just another one of activity of all the activities that we engage in. Be insignificance. It could just be something else that we do. We feel that it's important, but you know, this is what I do on Tuesday nights. On Wednesday nights I do that. There, you know. So on Tuesday nights, I'm acting a sage, but on Wednesday nights, I'm going to the bars and drinking, so I'm acting the fool. But that just describes their behavior, that's all. It's a word that describes, it doesn't, so I'm the same person Tuesday night at Sangha as I am at O'Reilly's bar on Wednesday night. One night I'm acting in a wise fashion, another time I'm acting foolishly. That's what the Buddha's pointing out. If I said that in relation to the Dhamma, yeah, this is where I'm using the example of here one night, the bar the next night. If I'm saying there's absolutely no difference in me tonight and tomorrow night, then I'm fooling myself. It doesn't matter if I'm fooling you, I'm fooling myself. I am the fool. It's important in my mind that I distinguish what is skillful behavior and what is unskillful behavior. unskillful behavior is foolish. Skillful behavior is rooted in wisdom. That's the only reason for the distinction. It's not to put down individual people.
Right, but it's that word, the characterization, that both of those are... Which goes back to what I was sort of trying to understand, because it's what we do or what we don't do by taking responsibility to be skillful. In that, I'm really trying to figure out, you know, sometimes in figuring things out, it's really clear at first.
Oh, yeah.
And then when I try to verbalize it, it's like, what? So, being in the weeds a little bit, or the thicket. But I'm walking, cutting.
Well, that's...
Walking, cutting.
Yeah. Let's bring it back to I think it was... You might have not heard this because I think it was Saturday we're talking about this, and from the Bhava Sutta, where the Buddha says that karma is the field, consciousness the seed, and craving the moisture. So, looking at it that way, it's what we hold in mind is what we're going to be planting in the field of our life, in our karma. Karma is the field, consciousness the seed, craving the moisture. So what I hold in mind is going to determine what I grow. And I'm going to be compelled to keep doing that by craving the moisture that has these assumptions I'm making about myself manifest in the world or produce in that field of karma.
The driving force.
Yeah. So if you think of that, think of your life as your garden, that it's up to you what you're going to grow in it. But your thinking, this relates to the Bhadrakarata Sutta, the gaining control of your thinking. Your thinking determines what you're going to grow in your field. So that points directly to you better clean up your thinking, or you're going to be throwing some pretty nasty seeds out there. And the way to do that, the way to gain control of your thinking, is to diminish craving. Craving is the moisture that fuels wrong thinking, consciousness.
So karma is the consciousness.
Karma is the consciousness. Karma is the field. Consciousness is the seed. Craving is the moisture. And you could really say craving and clinging.
So karma is the field.
Yep.
Consciousness
the seed.
Consciousness is in the seed. If you saw this,
yeah, that's in. It's in the. You don't have to,
moisture.
Bonnie. It's in the Bhava Sutta. B H A V A. And it's linked in last week's email.
Okay. I remember that, because to me that's so visual too. So keeping that in mind, it's a really beautiful metaphor.
Yeah, it's a good way of looking at karma, because then it points us to taking responsibility, to stop putting that second arrow in.
Mm-hmm. What's the first arrow?
The first, it's just the event that happens, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then reacting to it is the second arrow. Things happen. I mean, the difference between what the Buddha taught and modern and religions of his time and modern religions, it's not a way of escaping the world. It's a way of understanding the world. And what the Buddha is saying, that inherent in the world is suffering, is disappointing experiences. There is dukkha. It's by reacting to that that we set in motion the whole field of confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering. So we need to change the way that we're looking at the world. That's all it is. But we need a well-concentrated mind, meditation, and we need a framework, the Eightfold Path, in order to do that, in order to extricate ourselves from the delusion that we're in. That's all. Did you have something else, Bonnie?
Yeah, but people are probably going, oh, no, not another one. So, because I'm thinking this is in a positive light, karma, but...
It is. Well, it's not positive or negative, but... Useful.
Karma is the field, right? And then consciousness is the seed, and craving is the moisture. But craving, we want to be able to have cessation of craving, to not crave, to be.
Yeah, the Buddha's, and those three things, the Buddha's describing the process
of the second arrow.
Yes. And so relate that to right intention. Right intention is the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. It relates directly to the second noble truth. It states that craving originates and clinging perpetuates suffering. So if we can eliminate, again, this is getting right to the heart of the matter, the point of restraint. When we can do that, we're moving towards awakening. But, you know, that, this is where the difficulty of this simple and direct path is, because eventually it is an all or nothing path. You know, we either engage with it wholeheartedly if we're going to take it to its conclusion. I mean, there's benefits to dabbling in what the Buddha taught, you know, certainly the most wholesome teachings ever made. But if we truly want to awaken and gain the full benefit that an awakened human being taught, we're going to engage in it wholeheartedly and stop falling into the trap of the distraction that's rooted in ignorance. That's part of it. Pardon me?
It becomes a self-improvement program without it wholeheartedly being engaged.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Then you're just fixing
you still have that suffering.
Yep.
You might as well get an online tape.
Might as well. Mm-hmm. Yep. Might as well. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. You know?
Temporary.
Yeah. Well, it might not be. I mean, I honestly, during the Buddha's time and wandering around northern India, it's not every individual awakened. You know, they could have if they listened and practiced. So this isn't about salvation. It's about individual awakening. And so that's up to me. It's up to me to, and again, it points directly to karma too. I'm in what I'm in, whatever it is, whatever I'm experiencing, because of my past actions framed by the way that I'm thinking. Life is unfolding as it unfolds, and it always will. What I have control over is the way that I experience that, and the most skillful way is to develop a way of thinking that is framed by the Eightfold Path. Another way of saying it, a way of thinking that is framed by an awakened human being's thinking. I'll leave it at that. Any other questions before we finish tonight? So next week, we're going to get into rebirth, the second half of this chapter, and I'll point out a couple of suttas that I'll be talking about next week too in Monday's email. But I think we're going to spend a couple of weeks on rebirth. I don't mean to beat it up too much, but I think it's such an important and misunderstood teachings, and it really is what we're moving towards, is being mindful of what we're giving birth to in this moment. And so maybe it'll take a couple of weeks to get through that whole thing. But again, any other questions about tonight? Okay, our retreat's coming up May 17th. So I hope you can all join us. And if you can, please just sign up as soon as you can. Yeah, there's a little room left. Actually, a few people just backed out, so there'll be a little more room. All right, let's finish with metta, as we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And again, take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection, This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you, John.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.